I am Brody Hannon. I am interviewing Mr. John Gower today in his office at Citywide. The date is Wednesday, March 20th, 2019. First, Mr. Gower, I'd like to ask, when and where were you born?
I was born in Rochester, Minnesota on Bastille Day, July 14th, 1953.
What were your parents' names and what did they do?
Barbara, her job was to be mother to four children. And my father, John Allen, sold wholesale lumber.
Where did you go to high school?
I went to Chaminade High School, downtown Dayton.
And what was your experience like there?
I'm an introvert. You asked the question, if I could have skipped kindergarten, if I could have gone from kindergarten directly to college, I would have been really happy. I did okay. I'm just in grade school and high school, but I went to Chaminade. Of course, that's a school where everybody is involved in stuff. I'm one of those people that wasn't involved in anything. I was in the band. All of that being said, I'm really glad I went there because I had some really good experiences in terms of education and being embedded in downtown Dayton and the city and all that.
And where did you go to college, and what was your degree?
Went to the University of Cincinnati degree. I got a Bachelor of Architecture. It's a six-year program. It took me 11 years to get my degree because once I started co-oping, I ended up the last couple of years I was going to school, I was working 9 months a year, and then when I would go back to school for a quarter, I would take the minimum credit hours to save full-time, so it was 12 credit hours. Last couple of years I'd gone to school, I had already bought a house here in Dayton that I'm still working on and had gotten really involved in making the neighborhood that I grew up and lived in, part of it is an historic district.
Are you married?
I am not married. I am married to my city.
Tell us what you do for a living.
Okay, so I'm one of those people that for almost my entire career has come into work every day going, oh my God, I can't believe I'm getting paid to do this. For 85 to 90% of my career, I've loved what I have been doing. The first 25 years of my career, I followed the voices, and my bosses said, just keep doing what you're doing, and we're going to continue to support you. So I've been a very blessed person, and all I ever really wanted to do was save Dayton. So I was able to use my architecture and urban design skills, my interest in history, and it's all different kinds of history, and my abilities to imagine what could come forward here in a package where what I've done for most of my career is actually vision what we could be. And it's been ranging from just planting some trees all the way to concepting really large projects.
What do you like to do in your spare time, and do you have any hobbies?
So I've been working on houses. I've rehabbed 8 houses in my lifetime. I'm down to 3. I'm trying to sell 2 of them this year because I turned 66 this year, so I really need to scale back a little bit here. When I travel to see what's going on in other cities. My other big thing that I'm doing right now is my mother's going to turn 95 this year. She still lives in the house she and my father bought in 1962. I have a younger sister that lives with her. She's in really good shape, but she's really, I spend 3, 4, 5, 6 hours a day up and down, take her out. So I'm, my sister and I are very dedicated to making sure that she has a really high quality life. So in the last 4 or 5 years, there's been a huge amount of time that I've spent on that.
What are your first memories now moving to the arcade?
Okay, well, I'm going to start with the first memory of being downtown because I was 4 or 5 years old. This would have been the Christmas of 1957. We went to the department store of Reich's. They had all these windows. We went and saw Santa Claus. I was not a fan of seeing Santa Claus because he was a stranger. I was not into that. But the toy department had this awesome train set up, so I always liked to go and look at the trains. My first memory of the arcade probably was when I was 7th or 8th grade. And at that point in my life, I would come downtown either by myself or with my friends because I grew up in the city at the time where I would describe myself as a free-range kid, and I hung around with other free-range kids. We knew how to take the bus downtown and that type of thing. But I remember going in there, and I don't remember someone had said you need to go in there, but I remember going in there and looking up, and I had to squint because it was really dark because the skylight had been covered over decades ago. And someone had said you need to go in there and see the turkeys. And I remember going up there going, oh, I can see the turkeys. And I remember looking at the chandelier. And for a kid that from the earliest memories wanted to be an architect. So quick sidebar, I knew I was going to be an architect when I was in kindergarten. And I can actually remember the moment that and the time that that happened. And my kindergarten teacher, I was building something out of blocks. My kindergarten teacher came over. She was showing the room to some visitor. And she said, well, this is Johnny Gower, and someday he's going to be an architect. And I turned around, looked at her, and from that day forward, I knew I was never going to do anything else. So part of going into the arcade for my first time was seeing all this really cool stuff there. But it was just another piece of this whole adventure town. And for me, Dayton was all adventure town. Riding the electric bus, coming downtown, going into the old movie theaters. Almost all are gone. There were a lot of theaters down here up until the late 60s, early 70s. So the arcade for me was just another really interesting piece of a much larger adventure land.
What places did you visit in the arcade?
So when you went to visit the arcade, it was all just like one big place. And you walked in there, I remembered going by the Cheese Lady. The arcade was connected to McCrory's. I always loved going through McCrory's. They had a lunch counter, and they were always, they had these machines at the Kresge store in these old five and dime department stores where they were already always roasting either pistachios, peanuts, or cashews all day in oil. So I loved going in there and enjoyed the smell. And the arcade, I would just wander around. They had a little discount store right in the middle under the rotunda at the time that I was there. They had a restaurant that I'd never gone to called Culp's Cafeteria. There's a place that's sold pretzels, and in fact, they're still around, Smale's Pretzels. They're over on Xenia Avenue. I don't like seafood. They had fresh seafood, and I would walk by the seafood cases and think, blech. And then I remembered going down the 3rd Street Arcade. It always had a covering over it. It was originally a skylight, been covered over. So in my lifetime, it had always been a dark skylight. But when you went out to 3rd Street, it was completely open to the weather. So you could actually walk down there. It was like a dedicated public street. And then they had all these little storefronts. There was a coin shop in there, and I was in grade school and early high school. I collected coins, so I would always go in, look at the coin store. They had a barber shop there. I never got my hair cut there. I hated getting my hair cut anywhere. That's kind of what I remember about it.
What did the arcade look like on the inside?
It had the patina of ages of use on it. So you didn't really get the sense of the gloriousness of the rotunda and the coolness of the arcade itself. I just remembered it as this cool, older place to hang out that was interconnected with all these other places.
Having an architectural background, could you talk a little bit about the architectural style of the arcade?
Only in really broad terms. Because people before have said, what's your favorite building downtown? I say, I have a lot. That would be like saying, if I had 10 kids, who's your favorite kid? So I love all my children. And, you know, like most of the older buildings down here. The exterior of the 4th Street and the Ludlow Street facades are Italianate. The 3rd Street building is Flemish. It was actually patterned after Flemish Guildhall somewhere in Amsterdam.
Do you remember any of the people who worked in the arcade or would be there when you would visit it?
Only one person. It was in high school, and she worked in the grocery store. I was a year or two ahead of her. She worked in the arcade grocery store that was run by Leo McGarry, and in fact, I think she's being interviewed by you all. And all I remember is, you know, occasionally stopping into the grocery store, but she was the only person that I really connected with in the arcade because I'm an introvert. I was an introvert, and I've spent my lifetime, you know, overcoming that.
Did you know any of the people that lived in the apartments in the building? What are your strongest memories of the arcade?
Okay, so I'm going to fill in a hole that you haven't asked me about. So it's 1990s, early 90s. I'm working for the city planning. I'm the downtown planner. The arcade was renovated from 78 to 80, reopened in 80. I was down here for the grand opening. By 1980, I was working full-time for the city. I spent a lot of time in the arcade from 1980 to 1990, and it's a different period of my life and a different time for the arcade here. And in that case, I was spending a fair amount of time there because there was a lot of food. I remember Tommy Zarlakis, Zarlakis Brothers had a gyro shop there. I spent a lot of time in Charlie's Crab drinking beer and eating nachos. And retrospectively, I've kidded with folks about this, is I'd like to have an idea of how many equivalent 55-gallon drums of beer I process through my body at Charlie's Raw Bar. You know, because I'm in my 20s and my 30s, and that was, you know, you went out after work at night, and that's a lot of people went over there and hung out at the arcade and had dinner. They had a white tablecloth restaurant on the second floor, the Raw Bar on the first floor, and then during the daytime they had all these fast food operations. In 1985, 84, 85, the arcade went into bankruptcy, defaulted on their loans. The banks took control of the real estate. They decided to punch a hole in the floor because the food operations, even up until the very last day it was officially open, food operations basically paid the freight. They were always able to make their lease payments here because food works. And so they, in 1984-85, they took all the food operations that were on the first floor, put them into the food court, took the struggling retail from the second floor, and basically put that all on the first floor. And their objective was to get the arcade into a cash position, cash flow position, where they would be able to sell it on the market. So that never happened. And in 1990, the banks that had taken possession of it, there were two local banks, and Third National Bank and First National Bank held minor positions. I don't know if they were second or third mortgages. And then there was a bank out of Hartford, Connecticut, the that carried the lion's share of the financing. So they said, we're done. And they contacted Tom Danis. Tom Danis was the CEO of Danis Corporation at the time. This was early in his career as the CEO. He was very engaged in downtown. He had already built an office building, which is now the Premier Office Tower. And so the banks, the two local bankers approached him and said, would you take possession of this building here? And he said, yes, I don't know what I'm going to do with it. I'm probably going to close it. But this is such an important part of who Dayton is. I'm going to go ahead and do it. So everything closed in March of 1990. And for 15 years, he kept the place heated, paid the taxes, kept the water from dripping in there. He would open it up for events. And in the fall of 92 and the fall of 93, Paul Woody, who is director of planning at City Hall, Paul's a lifelong Daytonian. I think he may be interviewed by one of the folks here. Paul had this idea to reactivate the arcade for the holidays. And so he came up with this idea called Arcade Holidays. And a lot of staff people were involved in it. My role was to kind of play the role of, as the facilities guy. I worked with Steve Nutt. Steve Nutt works at Citywide here. Steve was kind of the guy was going to find the temporary users to go in there. So 1992, I really got to know this place really, really, really well. I was, at that point, giving behind-the-scenes tours, which I was not supposed to do. Had discovered the old apartments, the old office building, the awesomeness of the bones of the commercial building, the old sleeping rooms in the Third Street Arcade. Didn't spend much time in the basement because there really wasn't a lot down in the basement there. Learned how to, you know, where all the power centers were because we had to turn the lights off and on. And as part of the first holidays, we needed to decorate it. So there was a lift, and the lift is still over there, that would go from the lower level all the way up to the rotunda. And I don't remember the name of the landscape company. They also did interior decorating. We came in and hung Christmas lights from every bulb all around the rotunda. And it was magical. And in that first holidays, the day after Thanksgiving, there was always a tree lighting ceremony. It was so packed at 8 o'clock, and no one ever took a picture of this. At 8 o'clock, there were so many people in the arcade that you couldn't even move. And I was in the Third Street building because our first storefront that year was down on the ground floor. We operated a little storefront called the Vision Depot. And this was all about visioning the future of the city. This is almost going to make the hair on my neck stand up. It's not quite that kind of a moment, but it was pretty close to it. So we did that first year, very successful. Did it the second year in 1993. We had a changeover in elected officials at the city. And the new folks that came in and said, we're not doing that anymore. So, in the meantime, between 93 and 2005, Tom Danis then would open. I think he opened it up for the Philharmonic to have an event there. He probably opened it up to the opera for people to have events there. And by 2005, he was cycling out as the CEO. And before he left as CEO, and he paid for all of this out of his own pocket. So when he cycled out as the CEO, he donated it to another not-for-profit, and that really began the cycle of disinvestment deterioration. So I would say from 2005 up to today, up to actually 2015, which is when we did Dry and Stable. So for 10 years, it was in a cycle of physical deterioration. The not-for-profit that he donated it to in 2005 ended up transferring ownership, and it was in 2008 or 2009. They were delinquent in taxes. They had place had already started to have been stripped. There were folks going in there and taking out copper wire and all that sort of thing. Had never cleaned out the roof drains or the gutters. And when you don't clean out your gutters at home, if you have a house that has gutters and you don't clean them out and you let them sit for 10 years, you're going to have a problem with rot. And that's what was happening with the arcade. So in 2008-2009, Gunther Berg, who had found the arcade for sale online on eBay. The previous owner listed it for sale on eBay. Gunther lived in Wisconsin. He's originally from Old East Germany, had immigrated to the United States and had skills and experience in doing rehab. He was looking for a certain kind of brick, and he was online and saw this building for sale that looked like it had the brick that he wanted. So he said, well, I'm going to have to go there. I want the building because I want the brick. And he came down here, I think with the idea that I'd buy the building and then demolish it and I'd haul all these bricks back to Wisconsin. Gunther came in there, and of course, Gunther coming from Europe and thinking about the rebuilding of Europe after World War II and all of these countries that were devastated that were actually replicating their old cities, said, oh my goodness, you can't tear this thing down. So that started a whole nother phase with Gunther in that 2008 and 2009 period. That was when the Friends of the Arcade was established. Joanne Granzo, Mary Beth Graham, Leon Bay, and they had multiple open houses there. They were raising money. They put a little booklet together there to reignite interest in the arcade. Nothing really happened for that. And I'm going to back up here because I forgot the one piece where in the early 2000s, Dayton newspapers, who used to be located at the northwest corner of 4th and Ludlow, were looking to expand. And they said, our facility down here doesn't really fit us anymore. And they had decided to move the printing operation out of downtown into a new building down off of I-75 along near Franklin, which, by the way, now has been closed because they now have all of their papers printed in Indianapolis. Then the second piece of this is where we're going to move the offices. They did an exercise to look at going into a part of the arcade where they would actually have moved to the end of the rotunda and some of the other areas. Came back and said, we can't make that work, and they ended up buying one of the last NCR buildings that's still standing. There are two left. One's the one they're in, and then UD bought the second one. So that was in the early 2000s, and then there was a second push after Gunther had bought the building when Dayton Metro Libraries had gone out for a levy. A capital levy, where they were going to bring the Dayton system into the 21st century. The last time there had been major rebuilds had been the 1960s, so it was way overdue. There was a decision to be made about, are we going to stay in the existing building or we're going to go somewhere else? So there was an effort that Gunther had made, had some folks around town that were supporting him, to say, let's put the library into the arcade. At that point, he brought in his buddy Bill Strever, his friend, because Gunther works for Peter Emmons. Peter Emmons runs this company called the Structural Group. Bill knew about the arcade. Bill had probably been in the arcade. Bill Strever, who's a year older than me, is from Baltimore and built his whole career about renovating buildings in Baltimore. So he's like the quintessential Baltimorean, and it was like, we've got to save Baltimore. So Bill came into town. I remembered us having a dinner up in the Kettering Tower with Bill and Gunther and a couple of us from City Hall talk about the library. So that never gained traction. The whole library concept never gained traction. And by 2013, thing called Hurricane Ike. You guys, you may be old enough. How old were you in 2013?
I would have been 15.
15. Do you remember Hurricane Ike? That's this hurricane flew through Ohio, and actually we were out of power for 3 days. And this is like in August. Anyway, Hurricane Ike started blowing windows out of the commercial building. And at that point, it became a public nuisance and a public safety hazard. So the chief building official issued orders to say, you've got to make this building safe. So around that time, Gunther put out this heroic effort to board up the commercial building. And I got a call one day from the assistant city manager and said, have you been over there lately? And I said, no, I haven't. And she said, you better get over there right now. The guys from the building department are saying it's a disaster. So I went over there. It had rained earlier in the day. I was there over there in the afternoon. The rain had stopped. I walked in the arcade, but it was still raining in the arcade. And the reason it was still raining in the arcade is nobody had cleaned out these light wells. So the light wells would fill up in a rain and then just slowly drain through the day. So all the a lot of the 1980 improvements, the drywall and all of that had sort of fallen over. There's some mold. There had been vandalism and all of that. And at that point, it was time to sort of sound the alarm because this was not headed in a good direction. So in the mayoral election of 2013, we had two candidates. Mayor Whaley, Aunt Nan Whaley, who was a commissioner, ended up, she won the election. But in that conversation, there was discussion about the future of the arcade. And there were a number of folks, I'm going to use the term business community, that said, you know, it's time to just pull the plug and take that thing down. So the mayor, to her credit, said, well, I'm not doing that on my own, and we're going to have a public conversation around here because this is such an important part of who Dayton is. And there was a task force that was seated of maybe 10, 12, 15 folks, stakeholders that were around the table. There were predisposed opinions, I think, of folks walking in there. And even the folks that thought you needed to take this thing down would even say, yeah, it had unique characteristics about it, but there's no way to save it at this point. So David Williams and I were told to staff the committee, along with Rachel Bankowitz. Rachel is the historic preservation officer for the city. And we made a decision early on in the process to say, okay, we're done. We're going to conduct a clinical approach to what we're going to do here. We're done talking about the emotional aspect of this building. We've heard every idea from doing a museum, the library, Dayton newspapers. We're going to have a conversation about money here. And we were going to have to hire two consultants. One would be a professional demolition consultant, so we could actually find out exactly what the true structural condition of the building is, and then get a handle on the numbers to remove it. And then we also hired Jonathan Zanvik, a Zanvik Architects out of Cleveland. They have been at the forefront of adaptive reuse in the state of Ohio all the way back to the early 1970s. So we brought them in. Our charge, our marching orders to the architect was active ground floor uses, housing, everything from the second floor above. There's an opportunity to do a hotel there, do that, and let's put parking in the lower level. So they set about doing that because they have great experience in this. They were the architects for the reuse of the three arcades in downtown Cleveland. The demolition consultants, THP out of Cincinnati, we gave them, and I don't remember the exact number now because there are 7-8 buildings involved in this conversation that really our function is one. And So we came up with maybe a half different options on what would happen from taking nothing down to taking everything down and having a few options in there where we would actually take out the rotunda, remove the commercial building. And that was really interesting. So by January, February of early, that happened in the fall of 2014. Early 2015, the demolition experts came back and said, well, right now we think you're looking at a range of $8 to $12 million to do this properly, depending on which option you want to exercise. So we had that going on one hand. On the other hand, we had the adaptive reuse team saying, you know, there is a potential capital stack, access to financing tools today in 2015 that didn't exist in 2010, that didn't exist in 2000. So the toolbox for adaptive reuse in urban areas had been, from my perspective, significantly expanded over the previous 5, 10, 15, 20 years. Okay, so spring of 2015 comes forward. The task force is reconvened. The mayor brings everybody to the table. We start out with demolition conversation, which is, okay, we're looking at a minimum of $8 to $12 million to tear it down. Oh, and by the way, you need to do something in the next 12 months or it's possible that this thing could start collapsing on its own. Once that starts, it will be a cascading event. So their recommendation was, if you're not going to do this immediately, you need to spend some money here to make this dry and stable. The adaptive reuse architect said the same thing. So in that conversation with the task force, the question was asked, well, this is how much it's going to cost to demolish. Who wants to write that check? So no one raised their hand to write the check, and there was a very thoughtful, in-depth discussion that really began to emerge out of that, which is, if we're looking at a minimum of $8 million to demolish this, and if you choose that option and demolish everything, you've got not a very good parcel redevelop here because it didn't tear the entire block down. And then how do you come up with an idea that could be an attractive real estate investment that could be equal to or greater than the vibe of the arcade? So we came to that conclusion, said, I'm not sure we can do that. And the outcome of the task force was to recommend ultimately that the city step forward, spend some money on dry and stable to get it stabilized, and pronto go out and see if you can assemble a development team for this. And at that point, there was already some early conversations going on with Cross Street Partners and Bill Strever. Bill Strever, who was familiar with Dayton, had family in Hamilton, family in Cincinnati. And Bill's thinking was, I think we can give this a really good shot. And that really started the path forward on, okay, let's take a real good look at this. He was able to, Miller Valentine signed up and said, we wanted to be a part of this. Had that not happened, this project would not be happening because Miller Valentine was absolutely awesome. They came to the table, and early on we had a discussion about doing 9% LIHTC, 9% low-income housing tax credits, but approaching this as artists for housing for artists. And in our conversation, we were saying this is more than artists. This is about an emerging creatives community in Dayton. So, okay, I filled in that little hole that you didn't ask me that part of the question, but you were probably going to get to that.
Can you think of any specific problems at the arcade, like crime or segregation?
So this is interesting. Since I'm a lifelong Daytonian and I live in a part of town here, almost my entire life that's been integrated, and I have a little bit different lens that I look through this. But historically, from my perspective, the arcade was always a welcoming place to everyone, even when in the department stores people of color were not necessarily welcome into the department stores and the movie theaters. The arcade was really almost always an equalizer and a democratic space. And when it reopened in 1980, there was concern at that time because the interior spaces were dedicated public space. And if there had been incivilities or criminal activity, it was much harder to control. So I think that was a challenge from 1980 to 1990. I'm going to be really cavalier and very optimistic here in saying today we're in a very different world. And in Dayton, from my perspective, part of this energy driving the arcade is really being driven. Now, are you guys Generation Z or Millennials? Or are you on the cusp of the two?
Yeah, we're Millennials.
Okay. So, here we have old school Daytonians that are passing away, old school Daytonians that think it's over with for the city, old school Daytonians that were never able to reconcile fair housing to what was going on with more of an open society here. And here we have the emergence and the rise of millennials, and now behind you we have Generation Z, that from my perspective is absolutely awesome. And from the first group of kids we took through the arcade, we weren't supposed to give tours through the arcade in 86 and 87, I'm sorry, 2016, 2017. We did a few of them, and from the very first group of people that we touched, and they were kids, they were millennials, it became obvious to us that we had really turned the corner here, because these are people who don't carry steamer trunks of baggage staring into the rearview mirror, have a really different view of people, embrace diversity, are looking for people different than them, are looking for something authentic, are looking for something for real here. And that has, from my perspective, has only gained traction from those first experiences I had. And if there were an indicator for myself, and Dave Williams and I both talked about this, we had an open house last summer or fall. Downtown Dayton Partnership does tours once or twice a year of downtown housing projects. There was a decision made to say, why can we open the rotunda, the arcade? So there were some safety things we had to do. We made a decision to do it. This was for 3 or 4 hours on a Saturday afternoon. You were only going to get to come in and take a peek at the rotunda, and you were limited to 7 or 8 minutes. We had hundreds and hundreds of people walk through the arcade. The line went all the way down Ludlow, went all the way down 4th Street, and went all the way to Main Street. We had Daytonians waiting in line for a half hour, hour, hour and a half, waited in line to come in to see this thing for 7 or 8 minutes. And I would say every one of them was dying to tell a story. And they came in all different sizes, shapes, colors, ages, backgrounds, walks of life. And I only recalled one conversation that was even semi-cynical. So for us, this was maybe more a testament to what this place means to all Daytonians, as opposed to what does this building mean to just one segment or another segment or a different tier of Daytonians here. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
So kind of segueing off of that, what do you think the arcade does mean to the people of Dayton?
Well, first of all, it's a beautiful place. And when we walked some of the kids through there, kids that were already sold on Dayton, they walked through there and said, I had no idea there was anything this beautiful in the city. So number one, it's a beautiful place. I describe it as a cathedral. And it was a cathedral that was built to celebrate the coming together of people around food and market. So that means something. And the fact that from my own memory and my perspective, it has always been a democratic place in the center of the city for all people. There are all sorts of people, all shapes and sizes, colors, backgrounds, preferences, that have some stories to tell about the arcade. All sorts of people who had relatives, their old spinster aunt that lived in one of the apartments, one of the uncles that lived in an apartment and gave piano lessons. So I think that's really important. And then when it reopened in 1980 to 1990, there was a whole new generation of folks that were then able to shape, experience, and build stories of their own. And those kids today are probably a little older than you. So I'm thinking it closed in 90. So if you had been born in 70, you would have been 10 years old when it would have been open. You would be 30. You'd be in your 40s now. So there's a whole nother generation that has a whole new realm of stories and memories to talk about the arcade. And again, big deal about this was the public space. It's about the food. It's about coming together and, you know, hanging out at the restaurant, hanging out at the food court, everybody, it being open to everybody here. And we think, we believe that this is the springboard for the next generation here, is that this rediscovering this awesome cathedral, and this time being able to get the upper floors reactivated, which we were not able to do in the 1980 renovation. We basically, when it was reopened in 1980, what was reopened was the rotunda building, the arcade building, and the first and second floors for food and retail. The housing was always wanted. Everybody always said, we're going to have to get the housing reactivated. In late 70s, early 1980s, there were not the financial tools to be able to pull this off. And partly because this collection of buildings is a non-traditional piece of real estate. It's actually it's a civic building, but it has always been expected to perform as a private piece of real estate. And it's a civic building because it's got these incredible civic spaces, and they're absolutely awesome. They're inspiring. But what they don't do is generate revenue, and they're expensive in terms of the operating side. So that was always kind of, from a traditional real estate investment, the Achilles heel with the arcade. This time around, whole different ballgame. And this whole bringing together of infusing the entrepreneurship and the innovation culture that's not just happening here, it's happening across the country. And it's being driven by millennials, not exclusively with millennials, and soon to be help being driven by Generation Z, is, I think, providing the missing link in the 80 renovation that we're going to do now, because the entire thing's going to be reactivated. It will reopen as a city within a city. It's basically going to be 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, because we're going to have people living there. We're going to have folks in the hub that will work whatever hours they feel like working, and we will get the street level reopened, reactivated, and connected with the street, and fill this pivot, this functional pivot or hole that's been a hole in downtown since it was closed in March of 1990.
So, moving now to some questions about Dayton in general. When and why did you move to Dayton?
I moved here because my mommy and daddy told me we were moving here. And dad, he fought in World War II, got a degree after World War II in forestry. His first job was working in a lumber mill out in Bend, Oregon with Edward Hines Lumber Company. And my mother were married, had my two older sisters were living there. And then they moved from Oregon to Wisconsin before I was born. I was born in Rochester, and then we moved to Green Bay, Wisconsin, lived there for 4 years. And then my father father was transferred because he was a very good salesman. They said, we want you to take a larger territory. We're going to send you to Southwest Ohio. And they found a house on Cambridge Avenue, 641 Cambridge Avenue over by Rosedale. And that shaped my sisters, that shaped our family, that shaped my siblings and I. I remember coming down here to take piano lessons when I was 5 years old with my older sister who was nine. We'd take the bus. It was 10 cents. And it was a really big adventure to ride the electric buses. And then in 1962, my folks moved from Cambridge, moved a few blocks over to Bryn Mawr Drive behind Grace Methodist Church. And at that point in time, they were weighing whether to move out to Centerville to a Paul Welch new home or an older house in the city. And serendipity caused them to buy the house in the city. And while I didn't know I was in the early stages of this really deep love affair for my city, that really just strengthened it. And my mother still lives in her house. My younger sister lives with her. We've lived in the same neighborhood. We've lived in Daytonview since 1957. We love the city. We're passionate about the city. And we've never given up hope. Even though there were some really trying times for us in the cycle from the mid-1980s to probably 2005, 2008.
So what about your neighborhood has changed in the time since you first moved there?
Okay, so in 1957, the street that we grew up on was, I'm going to say, working class. A lot of four square houses, three or four bedrooms, very Catholic, lots of kids. We had one block that was bordered with two other busy streets, so our playground was actually in the street. So we'd play kick the can. I just really have all these great memories. My sister put on a play in the backyard of my mother's house, South Pacific. They're wonderful memories. We moved from there in 1962 to Bryn Mawr Drive, and bigger house, beautiful architecture, really big house, 3.5 bathrooms, big yard, not as much exciting going on in the neighborhood there because this was more a neighborhood of older folks that had kids that were a little bit older, but was a little bit different in that we moved in there at the time, it was still predominantly a Jewish neighborhood. So we had, you know, Jewish friends and kids, and I can't tell you really that really made any difference or anything here other than by the late 60s, early 70s, that had all begun to change. In the mid to late 1960s, so I went to St. Agnes School. Really important experience for me. It's taught by the Nuns of Notre Dame, which I would describe as, in terms of philosophy and faith, really close to the Marianists in terms of social justice. So when I started school, as a first grader, we were all white. By the time I graduated in eighth grade, we were probably a third African American. This happened when all the civil rights struggles were going on in the South. And I remember the nuns would bring in TVs. We learned how to sing spirituals and rounds. And it was a really important shaping, I know for myself personally, and probably other kids that I went to. And this really began to separate, from my perspective, those who really believed in social justice and those who don't, because we saw white families run and we saw white families say awful things while they were all running to church on Sunday. And for us, it being sixth and seventh, eighth grade, this was a real eye-opener for me, and understanding that not everything in life was consistent, is that people could say they hold certain beliefs on one hand, but when it came to practicing them and exercising them, it was a different story. So in Upper Dayton View, there was turmoil in the late 1960s because Colonel White High School at that point in time was shifting from predominantly white to a very integrated high school. And I remembered in the late 60s, they had lockdowns. They had Tyree Broomfield, and I think Tyree might still be alive. Tyree was African-American. I think he was a lieutenant in the police department, and Dayton created this intervention task force to actually help manage the peace there. But I remember specifically in 1969, I'd have to run home from the bus stop to the house so I wouldn't get mugged, because I went to high school downtown, and there was, I think in the spring of 69, kids coming down Euclid Avenue, breaking windows, throwing bicycles into people's houses, and that was a real test for folks that lived in that part of Dayton View, because what we didn't see were people saying, well, I'm getting the heck out of here. What we saw were people saying, you know, we're gonna help become part of the solution. And there was attempted block busting, but it was unsuccessful. And there was a real effort in the 60s and 70s from the folks who lived in Upper Dayton View, which today is known as University Row and the Dayton View Triangle. A lot of hard work on everybody's part, white, black, faith-based community, Jews, Catholics, Christians, everybody saying we're going to make this work. So for me, that really helped. That was an important part of shaping my life too.
What is your favorite thing about living in Dayton?
It's the perfect size. Nowhere else in the world do I think that someone who has a passion that wants to make a difference in their community, that may not come from status, may not come from money, may not come from a family name, you can make a difference here. Cincinnati's a little bit bigger. There's probably longer established lineage of families in Cincinnati. Much smaller here. I don't know that you can get the rich base of assets that we have here, for example, with the arts. And so I call it either the biggest little city or the little biggest city, or anybody here can make a difference. So I really love that. And I've been able to make, anybody here can make a difference. I am a blessed person to have been able to say that I've been able to do this stuff for almost my entire professional career, and I'm still at it. And looking at so many other folks here wanting to make a difference, and I'm so heartened because we've been anticipating your arrival, the millennials' arrival, and now we're anticipating the arrival of Generation Z. And there is a passion and a falling in love with that I'm seeing that I haven't seen from a large number of people for a long, long time. So I think first and foremost, size. I think Dayton's a beautiful city. And part of Dayton, getting to know its beauty, means you have to experience this not in an automobile. You have to walk the streets. You have to go through buildings. You have to know people. It's a friendly city. I've spent my entire life walking down streets and walking by people I've never met, and I always say, hey, and someone else will say, hey, back. They don't do this in a lot of cities that are even much larger than Dayton. So I find that unique for a city our size. I know that happens in much smaller communities. But in places, particularly where I live, which is across the river, and seeing outsiders' perspective, what they think across the river is, they're two completely different worlds. The perceived world is absolutely not on the mark. The real world is absolutely on the mark there. And so I think the friendliness and the size and how awesome it is and how anybody can make anything happen here, and a group of people here can really change the world. So there was this group that was formed a few years ago called CEOs for Cities. They have a name change here right now, and I'm trying to think of Lee Fisher, who was, I think, a senator and lieutenant governor here at one time, ended up leading that for the first few years. And their statement about CEOs for City is, if you want to change the world, you start with your own city. And I'm in love with that. And in my mind, I always say, you start with your own city, you start with your own block, you start with the people that you know. And this is all about retailing. And if you want to make a difference in the world, this is all retail. It's all one-on-one. It's all face-to-face. And you can make that happen here.
What would be your least favorite thing about the city?
Let's see. I have been frustrated with looking backwards now, not looking forwards. I've been so frustrated with the level of cynicism and hopelessness and giving up. And this is looking at Dayton and how it changed from post-World War II to the late 70s, early 1980s. From the post-World War II to the late 70s and early 80s, people used to talk about Dayton, the streets of Dayton are paved with gold. Dayton had a reputation for having the highest assembly line wages on the factory floor wages in the world. And people would come here. You didn't have to have a college education. In some cases, you didn't even have to have a high school diploma. And you could end up making really good money at one of the many factories that were here. When the economy turned global and the vanquished of World War II being the Axis powers, which was Germany and the Japanese economies, which were manufacturing powerhouses before World War II, began to emerge again, and the country was in this, we have to be competitive again, is I spent a lot of my adult life looking at folks who have become embittered because we're no longer entitled. And that period after World War II is never going to happen again. I don't know that it'll ever happen again in human history, that a conflict of that scale and a rebuilding of that scale. And I have to tell you this because you may or may not know this. At the end of World War II, the United States controlled 2/3 of the world's gold stocks. And the country, we carried half of the world's manufacturing capacity here. That will never, ever, ever happen again. And as I'm seeing older people being embittered, what I feel like I'm looking at are people saying, well, we've lost that. And I'm thinking, well, we never really had it. We were recipients of circumstances. And this is really not about being entitled to the best jobs in the world. You have to work for it. So what does that mean for Dayton? That's been a frustrating part of my adult life because it's been big. There are folks that were embittered. There are folks that have been hateful. And for the first time in a long time, this is the great gift of life and death, the cycle of life and death. If human beings and civilization did not have that, we would have destroyed ourselves a long time ago. So what's so awesome is to see the arrival of the next generations here with a very different perspective on life, a very different attitude, as opposed to people, baby boomers of my generation who grew up, and this was handed to them. And I'm not sure how many baby boomers ever really appreciated that this was a gift and it was not an entitlement. And I think there's sort of a rediscovering, repositioning of the country and Ohio and Dayton going on with this shift. And I'm completely optimistic that we're going to get there. And we're doing it because of the gift of the change of generations.
What changes do you think that need to be made to the arcade to keep it, when it reopens, popular?
Okay, I think the team that has put the program together now is they're right on the money. First and foremost, the arcade being reopened and not closed is critical to the economic health of the rest of the downtown. There's a backdrop economic strategy to this. So in the downtown core, give or take, we've got about 6 million square feet of commercial office space, give or take. 2013, half of that was vacant. Just quick sidebar, half of that was vacant partly because of the internet, partly because Dayton is a no-growth region. We've been in a no-growth region since the 1970s, and while there's been a lot of real estate development, we've not grown market. Okay, so 2013, we've got about 3 million square feet of vacant space in these previously built buildings, some being the antique historic buildings before the Great Depression, and then we added 2 million square feet of office space in the period between the 1960s and the 1980s, 2 million square feet, and we had it all filled. The arcade. So here's the backdrop. So we've got 3 million, in 2013, 3 million square feet of vacant space. Half of that are in buildings that are headed towards being abandoned. The arcade, the Fidelity building, the old Stomp Chevrolet building, the Center City building, the old Third National Bank building. There are people that plan ahead and think far ahead. And there was that thinking, Dayton's been blessed in that we have a legacy and a corporate function where we've been thinking ahead for a long time. And how do we manage through all these changes? And there is a recognition that if we don't intervene, we don't come up with a strategy to reactivate these buildings, we're looking at a $25 million minimum demolition cost, which the city does not have, because when the day is done, there's only one property of one property owner of last resort, and that's the local government. The other piece of it was, at the time, the local development community here was more involved in building on greenfields and really not much interest in adaptive reuse. So the charge going forward was, what do we have to do to attract and catch the attention of these adaptive reuse developers that are doing awesome things in Cleveland, Indianapolis, Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, and Columbus? How do we do that? And then how do we get the other 1.5 million square feet of the older mid-century modern buildings reactivated? So at the center of that initially was the discussion about Dave Hall Plaza. Dave Hall Plaza is in an old Midtown Mart urban renewal area. There's a park there that was built in 1974 as a temporary park called Dave Hall Plaza. And by 2013, 2014, it wasn't looking so great. So the first strategy was, if we want to reactivate these buildings, we're going to have to change the vision and the vibe of what's going on down there. And the first order of business is to overhaul this park and bring it into the 21st century. So without getting into how we got there. There was a community effort that was led by community leaders and the Friends of Levitt. We're going to put this awesome free concert venue in the park. And then what we've got to go out is we've got to do homework on these buildings that are headed towards abandonment. And that was being done. That was actually led by Dave Williams, who's now working with Cross Street Partners and helping to lead the arcade effort. When we first started this, Dave and I thought the arcade was at the bottom of the list. And what happened through harmonic convergence and the serendipity of all of this is that the arcade began to come out of that as a first order of business. And I think I had mentioned in our first earlier in the conversation that our first thinking of the arcade was it was all housing and then at the street level all activity. Two things happened simultaneously. Bill Strever, Cross Street Partners, who is at the forefront nationally for being able to interpret, capture, and harness this energy with the emerging entrepreneurship and innovation culture here, which is fueled in terms of people power by the millennials, but has also been grasped and engaged by colleges and educational institutions. We had that going on, and in the meantime, we had the Downtown Dayton Partnership leading an effort called Start Downtown, which was to discover where these grassroots explosions of entrepreneurship and innovation were coming. So those all came together in this discussion around the arcade. And for all of us who have been here for a long time, understand it at least functionally that the arcade has to be reopened to be able to at least reactivate the street level. Is the strategy here is we're going to have an innovation hub here. Dayton is catching the wave in terms of whatever we can do to encourage startups, small companies, and urge them to grow and have them graduate into the rest of the office building. So that's the foundation of the strategy here. So recently we had Chris Regal of Stratacash, who purchased the former Kettering Tower, which is now the global headquarters building for Stratacash, and the DP&L building on Courthouse Square. And Chris will be, I went to the press conference where they talked about what Stratacash was doing, and he's there. He actually was able to put Dayton in the context of a global value proposition in terms of being able to have the same things you have in a big city, having the same entrepreneurship spirit here. But unlike Southern California, we don't have any 800-square-foot houses that are for sale for $1.4 million. So the strategy is all integrated, and this is about reactivating the downtown, because urban areas, density, human civilization was all based on this coming together and this economic serendipity of different people coming together with different ideas, growing economic efforts, growing companies, growing ideas, and that's where we're headed. And I don't think this is an anomaly. I think when someone writes urban history, U.S. urban history in 2050, 31 years from now, I think they'll look at that period between post-World War II and the early 2000s as an aberration or an anomaly in American urban history, and this spread to the suburbs, to these low-density sprawling out, isn't necessarily good economic it's not necessarily very good economic strategy, because you lose the density. It's not efficient economically, and it can't be sustained over the long haul, because, and I'm going to talk really long haul here, in terms of oil. So I don't know if I answered your, did I answer your question or not?
I think so. Is there any other question, any other thing you'd like to share that we haven't asked yet?
No, I can't think of anything, but I'm sure I will when we're done with this.
Okay.